I call the meeting of the House of Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. Members, thank you for taking your seats. We do have a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 10th, 2020?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Wolgamott moves approval of the minutes for March 10th, 2020. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 10th, 2020 are approved. First of all, we have House File 3232 today, and I would like to welcome Representative Pawlowski to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 3232 comes out of the Winona mini session of October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of 2019. You may remember there was a hearing at, we still refer to it as the Winona Technical College. I believe President Lundblad will expand on the title of that institution and current date. At that hearing, former Superintendent of Schools Scott Hannon did a presentation on the need to restore technical hands-on learning at our high schools. We now call it industrial technology. We used to call it shop classes then. Some of you recall that the technical colleges were once vocational schools and they were linked to our K-12 system. About 30 years ago, we broke that away and we have seen a dramatic decline in hands-on technical shop learning in our high schools. What this bill does would create a 2+2, which would restore certification and licensure for industrial technology instruction at the high school level with 2 years at the technical school and 2 years at Winona State University. We no longer have this program in the MinState system, and this is to restore it. So today I have two testifiers. The first will be former Superintendent of Schools, Dr. Scott Hannon, and he is the one that did the testimony during the mini session.
Thank you, and welcome to our, come on, you can come up and provide your testimony. And as we do this, I have a motion from Representative Pryor here.
Yes, thank you, Chair Bernardi. I would like to move that House File 3232 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Well, welcome to the committee, Dr. Hannon. We want to thank you for your hospitality in Winona this past mini session. We learned so much and we had a wonderful time learning about your community and what we can do here at the legislature to be of assistance. So thank you.
Thank you, Chairman, and I'm sure you learned a lot more from the Super Bowl commercial too, which hardly anybody learned anything about Winona from, but anyway, we were glad to get the publicity down there in our fair town. Yes, I'm here to talk to you about the bill that we have at hand, 3232, and you're looking at an old shop teacher. I started my career in the district as an industrial tech teacher and taught for 12 years and then got into administration and finished out my career as superintendent of schools.
And Dr. Hannon, yes. Even though I said your name, could you please state your name for the record?
Oh, your Scott position. Hannon, H-A-N-N-O-N.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'm pleased to say that my father was an industrial tech teacher too, and he had gone back to school at the age of 40 back in 1955. And he was so old at that time when he went back to school, I shouldn't say back school, he went to college at age 40, that they waived his Phi Ed class. I don't know if they do that today, but and he finished in 3 years. And I'll tell you, it was from a standpoint of living in a shotgun house in Winona, in central part of town, and starting school in the fall with two pair of blue jeans that were about 6 inches longer than you needed because you grew into them during the year. I really learned that education was very important because I tell you, our lifestyle and our ability to put food on the table and drive a better car and put clothes on our backs changed after my dad finished college and got a job as an industrial tech teacher in Winona. And I'm also am pleased to say that I took his job when he retired because he started as an old age and finished up at as soon as he could. But anyway, so we're here to talk about this collaboration between Winona State and Southeast Tech. And in 2013, maybe some of you are aware that the world's best workforce was enacted by the state legislature here. And that was to ensure that every school district in the state is making strides to improve student performance. And one of the key goals, there's five goals of that, the world's best workforce. And I'll tell you, this put a lot of burden on school districts, especially small school districts that don't have the personnel to be answering mountains of paperwork every spring and turning it into the state. But one of those key goals was that all students are ready for career and or post-secondary education. Research that I read recently said that by 2020, and hey, we're in 2020, that over 65% of all jobs will require some form of post-secondary education. So somebody's got to make those kids aware in school about what the career possibilities are out there. When I was going to school, it was like the girls were going to be teachers or nurses. The men were going to be teachers or, well, maybe not so much teachers, but policemen or firemen. But now there's so many more jobs that are out there. You look in the ads for jobs every day, and it's like, holy cow, where did all those jobs come from? There's a whole bunch of them. So who is going to make those jobs a possibility? It's going to be the career tech ed teacher or the industrial tech teacher. Those are the people that understand what careers are available out there besides being a scientist or something like that. So career tech ed teachers and industrial tech teachers offer programs that offer academic and technical skills, knowledge, and training to succeed in future careers. But unfortunately, since 2004, there has been an 88% decrease in the number of industrial tech and career ed teachers receiving a license. 88%. That's unfathomable. In fact, since 2010, seven career tech ed teacher preparation programs in Minnesota colleges and universities have either been suspended or permanently closed, leaving either zero or incredibly limited pathways towards licensure for teachers in the state. So on one hand, the legislature is saying, hey, we want all these kids to be career ready, some kind of post-secondary effort. But on the other hand, we're not turning out people to teach those kids on what these career possibilities are. There's a real disconnect there. So that kind of brings us back to the bill at hand. And we're simply asking for one-time money. And why would we just ask for one-time money? We want to get a collaboration between Winona State and Southeast Tech going. If I'm sure you're aware that Winona State's the oldest teacher education college west of the Mississippi River. They just stuck $20 or $30 million into the Education Village to make it a premier place to teach teachers how to teach, how to assess, and how to be the best that they can be. Well, that's great. They've got all the courses on how to teach teachers. Southeast Tech has all the courses on the needs that like an industrial tech or career tech ed teacher would need. Woodworking, carpentry, welding, machining, courses of that nature. And they both offer all the general ed courses. So there just seems to be almost a no-brainer here. If Winona State has the teaching courses, the Southeast Tech, just a couple miles away, has all the hands-on courses, and they both have gen ed courses, why can't they collaborate and turn out career tech ed or industrial tech teachers without adding any classes, without adding any teachers, without adding any labs, materials? It's just almost too simple to be true. So we're asking for some one-time money to put this together and sort it out. The MREA, Minnesota Rural Education Association, endorses this collaboration. I was at a meeting 2 weeks ago of the Southeast Principal or Superintendents Association. There were 40 superintendents in attendance there. I asked them, I got a couple minutes on the agenda, and I asked them how they were doing with industrial tech and career tech ed teachers. You wouldn't believe the hands that came up. Now, 40 superintendents is about 15% of all the superintendents in the state in one room. Hands are going up. We can't get them. We can't find them. There aren't any. We've got community experts. We've got people on waivers. It's just not working out. We've had to close our program. We've had to reduce the number of kids, and it's unbelievable. So the need is out there. I also got an endorsement the other day from the Gary Amoroso. He's the executive director of the MASA, the Minnesota Association of Secondary Administrators, which is all the superintendents in the state. They're very much in favor of this collaboration between Winona State and Southeast Tech. I only had a couple minutes, but I condensed everything I said at the mini session, so try to keep your meeting going on, but it's kind of a no-brainer. I don't want to be condescending to the group here, but some things are simple and can do a lot for a lot of kids. You know, we've got an achievement gap in this state, and we want to close that. This will help. Will it throw hundreds of teachers into the pipeline? No, but will it put teachers into the pipeline that may reduce this drastic need? Yes, it will, and at very little cost to the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, I'm just going to make a reference to the two numbers that are online, 1.7, 1.8. Those numbers were developed by Winona State and Minnesota State College Southeast before the bill was introduced, and the bill was not introduced until they had accurate numbers of what they would need. Also, as far as the need goes, 2 years ago, almost to the day, Representative Nornes turned over an entire hearing when he was chairing the committee on a very similar topic on a bill I had that now Representative Albright is taking on the need that we have to have in our high schools, that every high school senior should have the option of graduating not just with a traditional degree, but also with an employable skill set. That was very common 30 years ago. It is no longer common today. And we have the need for employees, and we also have the need for those students to have the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Pawlowski, and thank you too for your all your work put into our mini session this that we all enjoyed very much. So I know that took a lot of work, and we want to thank you for that. So would you like to have your next testifier testify?
Yes, the next testifier is Dr. Larry Lundblad. He is the interim president of the Minnesota State College Southeast, or as we like to refer to it, the Technical College, with a great deal of respect. The hearing was at the Minnesota State College Southeast, and it is Dr. Lundblad that can tell you about what the $150,000 would go for and other things and the need.
Okay, great. And thank you and welcome to our committee. We enjoyed our visiting with the students there. They provided us with a lot of good insight, so thank you.
Good. Thank you, Chair Bernardi, members. I'm Larry Lundblad, interim president of Minnesota State College Southeast. I have to keep reminding Representative Pawlowski what the name of the college is, but Southeast Tech will work as well. And we were pleased to have the committee on campus and to have that interaction that afternoon. We covered a number of topics that included the genesis of this particular bill. So I'm certainly here to support House File 3232, and I'll amplify a few things from Dr. Hannon's remarks. Minnesota State College Southeast works closely with 22 regional high schools in our Perkins Consortium in southeastern Minnesota. And Minnesota State College Southeast is also creating regional hubs at the high schools to deliver advanced manufacturing college courses at the high school site to create pathways to the workplace and higher education. And we see firsthand the struggles that these districts are having in finding teachers. In addition to the current shortage, a number of current high school, current tech teachers are nearing retirement, and this will only make the problem worse. The lack of qualified teachers comes at a time, as was pointed out, when there's a worker shortage in the state and nation, and jobs are going unfilled in businesses because of lack of skilled technicians. As you heard in Winona, employers are willing to step up and to be part of the solution. Without high school programs, it becomes difficult to recruit students to post-secondary, trade, and technical programs when they do not get the exposure to the occupations in the high school, nor do they learn the prerequisite skills. Many students lack the knowledge of how to use basic hand tools, for example. Currently, right now, St. Cloud State does offer some courses, and they do have a licensure pathway in their computing engineering and environment program, and Bemidji State does provide some of the instruction. But this pilot will create a 2+2 program, as you heard, that will take the tech ed skills coursework at the Southeast, where the students will learn from on the state of art equipment and instructors who are skilled in the technical areas they teach. And then they'll take the pedagogical courses and required advanced work at Winona State, and they can meet the general ed requirement at either institution, as was pointed out. The appropriation will allow the faculty to really take a look at how what the best pathways would be and how to put the programs together. The program, proposed program, builds on the strengths of both institutions and utilizes resources already in place. There's no need to build labs on the Winona State campus. As was pointed out, they already exist at Southeast. Basic, pedagogical courses are already being delivered at the university. By starting at the Southeast, these learners will be able to get into hands-on courses right away that often match their learning styles. And by having the program start at Southeast, there's also potential that the students that are enrolled in programs at Southeast might be interested in pursuing a teaching degree. I would also like to point out that there's another pool of potential students for this program, and these would be Minnesota State College Southeast alums, individuals who have already received their associate degrees and who might be considering a career change. Some of our best instructors at the college are those who have followed this path. With two or more years of college, you would have an experienced, skilled technician who, with the 2 years at Winona State, would be ready to start teaching. I would also like to point out, as was mentioned, that this model can easily be replicated across the state. With the exception of Southwest Minnesota State University, six universities and two-year colleges are co-located with campuses just a few minutes apart. A modest investment of $400,000 will allow Winona State to hire a professor to develop the needed technical ed pedagogical curriculum, work on accreditations, and begin development of other aspects of the program. And for Southeast, dollars would be used to support a faculty position to work on curriculum and provide resources for recruitment and marketing. Once the program is up and running, just to point out again, it will be self-supporting through tuition revenues and state appropriation like any other program or major at our institutions. I would urge the committee to support this bill. It is practical, maximizes the use of existing resources, addresses a critical need, and can be replicated across the state. As you heard in the mini session, there is strong business and K-12 support for this partnership to address this teacher shortage, a shortage that affects the ability of our state to move forward economically. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Does anyone else in the audience like to testify? Would anyone else in the audience like to testify? Okay. We have Representative Lucero who has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if it's a question or more of just a comment. But as I'm looking at the bill language, I am a strong supporter of the trades, for sure. Trades and technical, absolutely. And as I'm looking at the bill language and the intent behind the bill, one of the things that caught my attention was on page 2, among the items that the funds would be used for is number 3, designing and implementing any needed course. So this got me into the thinking of a tour I took with multiple representatives. This must have been 2 or 3 years ago now, Anoka Technical College, and they were giving us a tour of the programs they had to offer up there, two-year institution, technical, obviously, institution. Mm-hmm. And the two items that they were telling us were the greatest needs that they had where number one, these were technical programs, and therefore much of the equipment needed as part of the academic portion was expensive. I mean, depending on the program, and I quickly try to make a list here, there was machining and metal fabrication, construction, welding, automotive technology, all of this equipment was hundreds of thousands of dollars, in some cases, per machine, mm-hmm. when it comes to machining or metal fabrication. And so when I'm looking at this, I'm not sure how realistic it is to design and implement a course, obviously, depending on the course, but that was one of their major struggles. Second, that they pointed out to us was there are one of the primary drivers of dissuading high school students from attending Anoka Tech or other similar programs at similar institutions was PSEO. Unfortunately, the courses that commonly make up a technical program don't transfer or don't fit in neatly to the transfer curriculum program that we have here in Minnesota that would allow students while in high school to take courses that they could then transfer to other institutions. And so it dissuades students from taking said courses because if they want to move on to a four-year degree, many of the courses they took as part of a technical program would not satisfy the needs of a higher education at a four-year institution. So anyway, those are the two things that came into mind. And again, just going back to the first point, which is the cost of technical equipment is expensive, and they had to rely on donations from private companies in those industries in order to even have the necessary tools, up-to-date tools. Mm-hmm. Right, when it comes to automotive technology, for example, think of the automobile today versus 30 years ago. Right, today it's filled with electronic equipment. So anyway, not a question. Did I hear a sigh? Are you frustrated over something? Okay. Well, I heard a bunch of noise coming from that side. But anyway, I agree with the intent of the bill, and we need to definitely create opportunities for technical programs, but it is expensive, and I appreciate the efforts in trying to come up with some solutions, so thank you.
I actually do have a question, and it's related to that in a sort of. So an AAS, this is regarding AS degrees generally, and so I just wanted to ask the question about AAS degrees, Associates in Applied Science. Are there any articulation in which somebody with an AAS degree can move into this program and get their licensed teacher? Certificate?
Yes. Chair Bernardi.
Is it Dr. or Mr.?
Doctor.
Dr. Lundblad. Yep.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Chair Bernardi and committee. Yes, the Associate of Applied Science degree is considered a terminal degree. However, there are a lot of articulations that many of our two-year colleges have with four-year universities. For example, our advanced manufacturing degree at the college, we have an articulation agreement with Milwaukee School of Engineering and also with Winona State. So the credits that the students take, the technical as well as the gen ed courses, transfer then into a four-year degree. So that is common across the system in many of our current technical programs. And so that's something we're very concerned with. We want to make sure that as we move forward, that the students have multiple pathways. So pathways to the workplace, pathways to further education, or sometimes to get into the workplace and the employer will pay for the education, continued education, and that's another a way to get a four-year degree if that's necessary.
Dr. Lundblad, would somebody be with an AAS degree be able to take part in this bill, or do they need to have those AS credits in order to transfer in?
Yeah, Chairman,
Dr.
this
Lundblad.
Is a 2+2 degree, so all the credits that are taken at the college, technical college, then will transfer part of that four-year degree. So it's a seamless 2+2.
Okay, so I just want to make sure, Representative Pawlowski, maybe you can help on this. I'm talking about, is it only with the AA degree, or is it the AAS degrees that would be able to do this as well?
The AAS degree.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you. Okay, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification. In the Minnesota state system, we have a student could get a technical diploma, they could get a certificate, or they can get a technical diploma, they could get an AAS degree, which is primarily technical credits plus some liberal arts credits, or they can get an associate in arts degree, which is more the liberal arts transfer degree. We do have AAS degree seekers who complete an AAS and could transfer potentially for a Bachelor of Science, or we do have some colleges that have Bachelors of Applied Science or BAS degrees, and that may be an outcome of this legislation would be that a student would receive an AAS potentially, and we may grow a BAS program. I think that this bill offers the opportunity to design and to understand what it could be to make sure that we deal with the transferability of credits and the applicability of the learning that they do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Poppy. Any further discussion? Okay, Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to say thank you for bringing the bill forward. I'm all about stackable credentials and making sure that people, when their lives zig and zag, they have different opportunities at different times so that they can grow and develop to their full potential, whatever that might be on their own timeline. So thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Pawlowski.
To that point, when the hearing was held in Winona, and Representative Hortman was there. Representative Hortman then had a conversation with Dr. Hannon. As a result of that conversation, Dr. Hannon contacted me, and then the bill began to be drafted. So this bill has been in the works since the mini session, and it's gone through a couple of different redrafts. But again, had we not had the mini session, this bill would not be before us.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Pawlowski, so this is a bit of a pilot, and so if things work well, it can be exported to the rest of the system?
Madam Chair, Representative, exactly right. This is meant to be a prototype, that once this is up and running, other colleges and universities can replicate it. That's the intent.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah, it's a wonderful bill. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or further discussion? Representative Pelos. Oh, okay. Representative Lehman.
As long as we're giving compliments and not questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want you to know that your bill is already well known, and I was in a meeting yesterday with area schools and cities from the Iron Range, and we were talking about the bill. And I was sitting next to my school superintendent. I asked him. He said he was all in favor of this. And the transferability possibilities that this could be a pilot that, you know, could make its way up to northern Minnesota to maybe some of the colleges there. I met with my builders. They're in the building today, Minnesota Association of Builders. They are just really looking for young construction workers. I mean, that's a real challenge for them. And so if we can help that by bringing teachers into the classroom and encouraging people, that's going to be another credit. So just want to say it's a good bill, and I just signed on as a co-sponsor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So any other discussions or compliments that anyone would like to give today? Okay. Representative Pawlowski, do you have any closing comments?
Yeah, I'll end with this. I taught at the high school for 37 years. For a good time of that, Dr. Hannon was our superintendent. I had the only digital projector that, like this, was embedded in the ceiling. And when the light bulb went out, the old joke is, how many superintendents and legislators does it take to replace the light bulb? And the answer is one of each.
Well, thank you for your testimony today and coming up here to testify. Thank you, Representative Pelosi.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, excuse me. We're not. Yeah. So we are not done with this, but you can you can move if you want. But Vice Chair Pryor is going to renew her motion.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to renew my motion.
That House File 3232 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Our next bill up today is Representative Cantrell's bill, which I would like to move House File 3122 to be laid over. Welcome to the committee, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. It's an honor to be able to appear before you today.
And I understand that you have an amendment, A2 amendment. Would you like the author's amendment? Would you like to discuss that right now, and we can move that as well?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would very much appreciate a member of the committee moving the amendment.
So I will move that the A20 amendment be put in the form. Okay, A20-0704 amendment be put into the form the author wants. All those in favor, aye. Signify by saying aye. Aye. All those opposed, the motion carries and the amendment is adopted. Representative Cantrell, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's an honor to be able to present House File 3122 before you today. House File 3122 requests that the University of Minnesota Board of Regents assemble experts from across the field of genetics and bioinformatics to assess and develop the possibility of expanding the accessibility of what is called pharmacogenomics, not only in application within the cities, but application across the vast geographic areas of our state. Pharmacogenomics is a relatively new field of medicine, and more specifically, it's a new field of quantitative prescriptive precision medicine. Each of us has our own individual genetic makeup, and therefore each of us has the likelihood of reacting differently, either in the positive or in the negative, to different medications. Some medications, like antibiotics, are kind of one size fits all for lack of more extrapolation. But when it comes to medications, for example, like antidepressants, I have known quite a few people who have benefited from the use of pharmacogenomics, whereby they give their physician or their practitioner either a blood or saliva sample, and from that, their genome or their genetic code is analyzed, and then we are able to, or their practitioner, I'm not in those conversations, their practitioner is able to ascertain whether or not drugs like Wellbutrin might work better for them, or Prozac, depending on their genetic makeup. So we are, as time moves forward, further expanding the applicability of the field of pharmacogenomics in order to ensure that when folks need medicine, that they don't have to go back into this trial and error thing again and again and again. Because especially with people who have complex conditions, difficult to treat conditions, and conditions like anxiety or depression, time is of the essence. So with that, Madam Chair and members, and I do want to say one thing really quick. I do want to thank Madam Chair Representative Quam for all his work on this. It's been a pleasure to have many conversations regarding the need to expand this area and really refining this bill to something that we feel is a good product. So thank you, Representative Quam, for all your work. It's been a pleasure to team up with you on this. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it to my testifiers.
Oh, thank you, Representative Cantrell. Would you like Dr. Jacobson to start now, or Mr. Greg Ornick?
Madam Chair, I believe having Dr. Jacobson commence right now would be fantastic.
Okay, please say your name and physician and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and distinguished committee members. My name is Pamela Jacobson, and I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota in the College of Pharmacy, and I direct the Institute of Personalized Medicine there. I'm a member of the Masonic Cancer Center at the university, and with my fellow faculty members, Constantine Alaferas, Susan Wolf, and Catherine McCarty, I am leading the university grant, one of the Grand University Grand Challenge research initiatives that is looking at how pharmacogenomics could be used for more effective medication use in Minnesota. I'm a pharmacist by training, and in the first 10 years of my career, I implemented the clinical pharmacy services for the bone marrow transplant unit at the University of Michigan. Through that work, I know firsthand the tragedy of cancer drug failure and the despair of life-taking toxicity. Now at the University of Minnesota, I have since devoted my career to improving the safety and efficacy of medications, and for the last 15 years of my career, I've studied pharmacogenomics as a tool to improve medication use and reduce costs. I appreciate your efforts to learn about pharmacogenomics and its role in healthcare, and I thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today. I would like to share with you some facts I believe you should consider as you determine the appropriate legislative role in helping to improve the health of Minnesotans by using cutting-edge medical genomic technologies such as pharmacogenomics. First, pharmacogenomics is a form of precision medicine. It is the science of using DNA makeup of cells to predict how effective or how toxic a medication will be, thereby providing each patient with individualized therapy and or dosing. In the last 20 years, much has been learned about the relationship between medications and genes, and the science is now sufficiently mature for implementation into clinical care. We already follow a precision medicine approach in cancer care. We actually do genetic testing of the cancer cells themselves. Cancer medications are then tailored to match a specific mutation in the patient's tumor. This happens in about 10% of all cancer cases. It has become standard of care, and it is working. Our cancer treatments are getting better, and cancer patients live longer lives. But with pharmacogenomics, we can look at a patient's inherited genetics, which then can guide decisions about the medications they use for conditions beyond cancer. Every one of us sitting in this room today has taken a medication. And nearly everyone here, 4 out of 5 of us, will also have an inherited genetic mutation that could affect how effective or how safe a medication could be. In other words, your DNA from mom and dad determines how you will tolerate or respond to some medications. While a handful of healthcare organizations across the country now use pharmacogenomics clinically, no state has yet undertaken a comprehensive implementation. Most Minnesotans do not have access to pharmacogenomic guided healthcare. This key innovation remained underused due to complexity of the understanding and using of genetic information, need for advanced IT type of support, serious lack of health workforce trained in its use. These barriers could be met and overcome if the state takes advantages of the expertise, existing leadership, and educational infrastructure at the University of Minnesota. I and my colleagues are currently leading a group of 70-plus faculty and external partners to advance the implementation of pharmacogenomics in hospitals, doctor's office, long-term care facilities, and pharmacies across the state. Our work is being funded at the moment by an internal set-aside of university funding that was designated to build a key component of the university's strategic plan to advance transformational research in areas where the university is well-positioned to have a great impact on the most critical challenges of our state. Our pharmacogenomics project falls under the grand challenges of advancing health through tailored solutions. Our grand challenge award was, in fact, inspired by the legislature. A report that was delivered to the legislature in February of 2014 by the Minnesota Department of Health highlighted for us the imperative to advance health equity in Minnesota, and we determined that precision medicine offered a potential solution to the stark inequities in health that are described in this report. Our current initiative convened in January 2019, and we began laying the essential groundwork for evaluation of pharmacogenomic implementation. Work groups are pursuing projects in education, health economics, technical architecture, and clinical decision support tools. We have shown through pilots that organizations are hungry to improve the safety and effectiveness of medications for their patients, and that they will implement complex technologies with appropriate support and resources. What is interesting is that our effort developed very quickly into a strong multi-institutional and interdisciplinary project. Our group involves healthcare organizations, pharmacies, clinicians, educators, and researchers from organizations such as Mayo Clinic, Children's Minnesota, Essentia Health, and Sanford Health. Thus, we conclude that many organizations in Minnesota are excited about using new technologies to benefit their patients and are ready to consider pharmacogenomics to improve medication outcomes. That is the strength of the university's unique role here. As the state's public research institution, as a land-grant university with a responsibility to bring the benefits of new discoveries to our citizens, we are obliged to take the existing investments made by the legislature and apply our knowledge in ways that can benefit Minnesotans in every county, rural or urban. But while it seems it may not be necessary to have a state involvement to bring together a group of health professionals in exploration, there is a limit to what we can do without express endorsement and mandate from this body. That is why we ask for this measure to be passed. This bill before you will provide legislative authorization for a task force of experts to conduct analysis of the strategies needed to rapidly and successfully implement pharmacogenomics, assess the educational needs of our state's health workforce, get input from the public regarding pharmacogenomics, and consider the needs of diverse, underrepresented, disabled, and rural patients. The university will leverage its mandate to seek external grants from philanthropic and corporate donors, and legislative authorization would improve our chances for successful fundraising. The expert task force will deliver a clear and informed report on the benefits, opportunities, and challenges of pharmacoeconomics, pharmacogenomics, and a roadmap for scaling up pharmacogenomics equitably into state healthcare statewide. If the state of Minnesota would make a commitment to pharmacogenomics, I have no doubt we could lead the nation in implementation of a cutting-edge science to improve the health of all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Greg Gornick, will you be testifying now? Say your name and your position for the record and provide your testimony, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Gregornik, and I'm the director of the Clinical Pharmacogenomics Program at Children's Minnesota in Minneapolis. I'm a native Minnesotan from Brooklyn Center and graduated from the U of M College of Pharmacy. I completed postdoctoral training at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, a pioneer in pediatric pharmacogenomic research and clinical implementation. I worked as a clinical pharmacy specialist in the St. Jude Pharmaceutical Department for 18 years, caring for children with catastrophic diseases. It was during this time that I learned the value of pharmacogenomics in reducing suffering of children from ineffective drugs and adverse drug reactions. Because of the strong scientific evidence associating genetics with medication toxicity and effectiveness, every child that receives care at St. Jude is offered pharmacogenomic testing. These results guide drug selection and dosing in children with cancer, bleeding disorders, and many other conditions. There's been tremendous growth in the field since 2003 when the Human Genome Project was completed. There are now guidelines for pharmacogenomic testing for medications used in cancer, cardiology, infectious disease, neurology, and importantly, mental health. I was recruited to lead and develop a pharmacogenomics program at Children's Minnesota. That program includes a pharmacogenomics specialty outpatient clinic and an inpatient consult service where we see patients who are struggling with ineffective medications and/or toxicities. Our program provides pharmacogenomic testing for children with cancer, mental health issues, and other medically complex conditions. We are one of the only clinics in Minnesota that offers formal pharmacogenomic testing for children and adolescents. There are a number of reasons why we are one of only a few places in Minnesota providing this care for our children. First, pharmacogenetic results are complex, and few providers have the educational background to understand how to use the results. Second, electronic health records are not currently built to manage and handle this type of information effectively, and special systems must be designed to manage the data. Results of pharmacogenomic testing will last for an individual's entire life, meaning that once variants are tested, they do not require retesting and must be available to use in future medication selection decisions for the child. A third obstacle is that most Minnesota insurance payers do not yet reimburse us for this testing, despite the scientific evidence. Outside of some limited financial aid programs, most patients have to pay for their pharmacogenomic testing out of pocket, which is impossible for many of the patients who would benefit most. We've worked hard at Children to address these multiple barriers, but few other organizations will have the expertise and resources to implement pharmacogenomic guided care. Hence, the majority of Minnesota residents do not and will not have access to the benefits of pharmacogenomic testing. Before I finish, I would like to tell a story about one of the first patients on whom I was consulted at Children's Minnesota. She's a 19-year-old female who had an 8-year history of struggling with major depression. She has a history of multiple hospital admissions and suicide attempts. Her list of unsuccessful medications over the preceding 8 years was long. Many of the medications caused her intolerable side effects, nausea, diarrhea, excessive sweating, and hot flashes that prevented her from taking them as prescribed. Additional supportive medications were added to stabilize her mood and to help her sleep. She underwent pharmacogenomic testing, and her results revealed that she had a decreased ability to break down or metabolize many of the medications that had caused her side effects. A new medication was selected based on her pharmacogenomic results and that was metabolized completely differently from those that she had not responded to. This new medication did not cause any intolerable side effects, and she was able to take the medication as ordered. Within a few weeks, she was showing signs of improvement, and eventually her psychiatrist was able to stop one of her supportive medications and greatly decrease the dose of another. Her parents were overjoyed with her response, and later that year, she was able to take a full load of classes in college for the first time. She continues to do well on her current medications. If we had been able to test her earlier, I believe we could have prevented her adverse reactions, as well as getting her on an effective medication earlier. In closing, I strongly support the establishment of a pharmacogenomics task force, and would be willing to serve on that task force to benefit the citizens of Minnesota, especially our children and adolescents.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Gregnornik. Oh, it's doctor, right? Yeah. Sorry, I didn't have that in my notes. Thank you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is to the bill author. As I'm looking at this, I'm looking at the bill language. I'm looking at line 1.13. It says the PJX task force may consist of public members appointed by the Board of Regents or a designee. Then I go down to 1.16, and the Board of Regents shall appoint. And I'm just wondering, should there be consistency between the may and the shall, or do we have the authority as a legislature to use the word shall in regards to the Board of Regents?
Do you want me to ask our staff up here to help us get that question answered, or would you?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you. Mr. Williams.
Chair Bernardi and Representative Lucero, I think that it would probably be a good change to change that may on 1.13 to a must, so perhaps we could do that through an oral amendment. That would address the concern, I think. It would be clear that the task force must consist either of public members by the Board of Regents or designee according to paragraph C.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Okay, yes, Representative Lucero.
I'll leave that up if somebody wants to take that. Just pointing that out. And the second question I would have is on the next page, when I'm looking at the, in relation to that same, the members that must consist or would be appointed by the Board of Regents, it's then included in paragraph C. And it includes members such as at least two pharmacists, two physicians. I'm seeing a long list here, an expert of health informatics, a genetic counselor, et cetera. But then I get to line, or to number six, a patient, caregiver, or provider who is a member of a diverse and underrepresented community. Could you, to the bill author, could you please define, or is it in here somewhere, what is the definition of diverse and what is the definition of underrepresented?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lucero. You know, I'm probably going to end up kicking this one to research, but I will say that I think it's fairly self-evident. Any member of a community that isn't in the majority would, by definition, I think, be considered to be diverse and underrepresented. But in case a future court listens back to this record, it means anybody who's a member of a marginalized or heretofore and ongoing member of a group that would be considered to be in the minority in the United States or in the state of Minnesota. So, but I'll kick it to research if they have anything else.
Okay. Representative Quam, did you, being the original former author of this bill, do you have a comment that you would like to make? And then we have Mr. Williams here to help us out as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And basically, there are multiple bills I've heard this year in various committees where this is a common reference, because in the medical area there are fairly well-developed understanding of underrepresented, and generally it's more of a, an isolated, genetic population that maybe has slightly different medical needs, or there's differences. And so you need to, when you look at delivery, to be able to address, some of the difference. Like an example might be medical treatment on a reservation, medical treatment to a community that maybe an immigrant community where they have, you know, some different norms, interaction. And the HHS committees, it's fairly common to understand that not all communities are identical. And, you know, staff can probably, you know, say if there's a, you know, clarify the definition, but this is a common phrase in bills that have to do with medical care. I think Representative Moran had two earlier this week heard in GovOps, State Gov Finance, that utilized similar terminology.
Thank you, Representative Quam. And we will have Mr. Williams help us out with this as well.
Chair Bernardi and members, I think that the bill doesn't describe exactly what the community that's underrepresented would be underrepresented in. So it might be worth thinking about potentially an oral amendment, or if the bill moves in the process, doing some additional work to clarify what's meant by underrepresented minority, because that's not defined elsewhere in the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm not done.
Okay, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, to the bill author, no, I don't think it is self-evident. That's why I'm asking the question.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, I think in your context, what you're describing when you use the word self-evident, you're probably talking about race or ethnicity or something like that. In this context, when we're talking about genealogy, right, and as he described, as Representative Quam described, I fully agree. There are differences. People can have different medical treatments. And I forget the name. I'm not in the medical industry at all, but is it hemophilia? What's the name of somebody who gets a cut and it doesn't, hemophiliac, where the blood doesn't clot, right? They mean to be, they're certainly going to be an underrepresented community because they're going to be a minority of the population, right? So are you talking about medical or are you talking about albinos, right? They have different medical situations too. So are you talking about sexual preference? I don't know what you're talking about. So I know you think it's self-evident. I know it's in your head. But I think when it comes to this bill language, and we're talking about this, some of the explanations that Representative Quam just gave are very reasonable, but I think we should probably define some of this language. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. We have Representative Pryor, Vice Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So your testimony is really persuasive about the value of this precision medicine and the line of research and how to advance it as a treatment option across the state, which sounds very exciting. But also, could you talk more about how this task force, or I have to use the, it's not a task force, it's a...
It is
a task force. How it's the solution to, or part of the solution to advancing this field and this treatment option, and how it fits in. So doing a report back to the legislature will help advance this field. And if you could talk more about how that's going to work.
Sim Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Pryor, for your question. You know, I think that one of the tremendous benefits of this bill, should it be enacted into law, would be really with the kind of an endorsement and in the support of the legislature to assemble a group of folks who not only are the beneficiaries or would be beneficiaries of this technology, but the folks who have been working on this technology and are at the forefront of this field, coming together with a defined goal to then bring back to the legislature ideas in how to expand the accessibility and expand the use of pharmacogenomics or, you know, precision medicine in the diagnosis and treatment of medical illness across the state of Minnesota. So I think the real benefit is having that direction to call folks to the table, much as would be the benefit of many task forces. And then having a defined goal that then they can collaborate on and then report back to the legislature with recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Vice Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you anticipate that there would be possible legislation or recommendations for legislation that would come out of the work of the task force?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Pryor. You know, that's possible. That's possible. Or otherwise, it could be recommendations for best practice. It could be recommendations for reforms in training. It could be recommendations for, I think, a litany of items that may include possible legislation. But also, I think it's quite expansive in terms of how this technology may be proliferated throughout the wider healthcare market in Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you. What I'm going to do now is ask for anyone in the audience who would like to testify on this bill, and then move to our final four people on the list to ask questions so we can give Representative Damuth her time presenting her bill as well. Anyone from the audience would like to testify on House File 3122? Okay. So Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will work with the author. I believe there's an existing section of statute with a definition of, you know, that would cover this. If not, we will have a clarification definition added, which is, you know, pretty straightforward. I spent several terms on HHS committees, and so I was am more used to this being utilized. I think it was around 2016 when pharmaceuticals passed hospitalization as the major cost driver for healthcare expenses. And we argue back and forth about costs of prescriptions, et cetera. This is a verifiable way to avoid pharmaceutical costs. If you get the right medicine the first time and close to the right dosage, it doesn't take too many prescriptions to cover. And it was touched upon where someone has a mental health issue, frequently a year and a half to find the right med and tune it in. During that year and a half, the readmissions, and unfortunately, some people don't survive the year and a half. And there's a lot of ways that we can intelligently cut costs and provide better care through this. It was earlier this month, the FDA released 10 pages of associations so that if you get the test taken, 10 pages of medications where you have the association, you find out if it works or doesn't. If you're native Hawaiian, you have a stent put in, there's the anticoagulant that is almost always, that's the one they prescribe, is not effective with Native Hawaiians, and you can understand the complications that come from that. So it's not just the avoidance of prescription costs, it's the avoidance of unanticipated complications, which tend to be extremely expensive. You're one in the 100,000 that has a severe complication from a medication. You can avoid this. Now, what this task force is going to do, it's going to allow for commonality in the approach and definition. So when there's a portal interface for the physician or the doctor, we can have sort of a set standard and agreement, and Minnesota can lead so it works for us. And it's about time, because Minnesota's been a leader in medicine, that we, again, take over leadership in this, because this is the cutting-edge way that not only better care, but more economical care for our patients, and I would hope you to consider this bill, because it'd be nice if we had this 5 years ago or 10 years ago, because I think we would have saved a lot of medical costs.
Okay, Representative Lehman, I'm trying to get to Representative Damuth's bill, so you can ask what questions you want, but it's at the expense of her testimony, so I just wanted to let you know that pressure's on now, but I just wanted to respect her testimony as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my question just relates, I guess, overall. This is the creation of a task force, and the amendment removes the request for funding. So my question is, why does this need to come to the legislature? Why can't this be, why can't the Board of Regents hear this good testimony, see the need for this, and create a task force? I mean, I feel a little uncomfortable as a legislature telling the University of Minnesota on one hand to cut costs and lower tuition and so on, and then on the other hand, we're giving them an unfunded mandate to create this new task force. I feel a little uncomfortable doing that.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, and thank you, Representative Lehman. I hear your concern. You know, to the question of why doesn't the Board of Regents just do this, well, they haven't done it yet, right? So that's the point of bringing this legislation forward, is to provide even, it's not to force an unfunded mandate on somebody, it's really to provide for kind of a directed, concerted, and kind of thoughtful approach to bringing folks together through the apparatus of the University of Minnesota to explore this field of medicine that really is, I think, the future of medicine and precision prescribing. So to the concern that you raised, I understand what you're saying. However, it hasn't yet been done. So I think that when we see folks throughout the state that we're able to kind of collaborate with, not pick up the mantle on something, that it's then our responsibility as a legislature to provide that direction, or at least that endorsement to bring people together. If it's not happening organically, then I think it's appropriate as our role as a legislature to at least say, hey, this is the direction that we think things should go in.
Representative, yeah, Madam Chair, in the interest of time, I'm not going to pursue this line of thought other than to say it would be good to see the University of Minnesota in support of this effort. Thank you.
Okay. And Representative Cleveland, are you yielding your time to be able to move on to represent? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, do you have any closing remarks, Representative Cantrell?
Chair Bernardi, members of the committee, I greatly appreciate your time today to discuss this really important issue. I know that this is a rather complex issue, and we're talking about somebody's genetic basis for reaction to medications, but this is something that I think can not only reduce costs and improve patient outcomes, but I think it is something that can put Minnesota at the forefront of leadership and medical advancement. So I do appreciate your consideration today, and I thank you again for having me before your committee.
Thank you. And hearing no further discussion, I renew my motion for House File 3122 as amended be laid over. The bill is laid over. Well, welcome to the committee, Representative Damuth. I was trying really hard to get you on at the testifiers table as quickly as I could. So
I appreciate
thank you
that,
for
Chair.
Your patience.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, and I want to know who would like to move House File 4168 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, so moved. Representative Lean moves that House File 4168 be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee, Representative Damuth. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. House File 4168 increases transparency for prospective students by requiring public universities and private colleges and universities to disclose tuition and fees, provide an estimated timeline for completion of undergraduate majors, provide information on success, in-placement, and an estimated income. This information would be posted to the university or college website and then included in promotional materials. And with that is my bill.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 4168? Okay, is there any further discussion on House File 4168 by our committee members? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Damuth, can you just explain how this is different from what currently is required?
Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Poppy. Some of the universities and colleges do have some of this information available. There's also a little bit available on the DEED website. This would bring it together in one place on the website or in promotional materials that prospective students or families are looking at.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you. Do you have, I guess I know we've done this in the past. We've asked the colleges and universities of the state to provide this information, and I guess I'm I think it's, again, it's a reasonable request to ask them to do that. Again, just probably unclear about what is missing at this point that could be provided, and what, and then maybe what would be the reason to do it. I think right now we're students are, you know, have choices on where they're going and what they're doing, and so I just maybe just a little bit more clarification about why you're bringing this forward.
Representative Damon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Poppy. Just having that transparency again, so that as students are choosing their undergraduate majors, that they would definitely have the information needed as far as what the possible income could be, what that particular college or university has in record as far as their placement success.
Representative Poppy, do you have a follow-up?
No.
Okay. Representative Seaborn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing the bill. I understand the intent, right, and I think it's a very good intent. However, I have a few concerns about it. So my son is a liberal arts major, and he went on to get a degree in something else. And that something else makes it appear that his income is much higher than, let's say, $45,000 that another liberal arts student who might attend and get the exact same degree would receive. So my question is, the idea is good. The data, especially when you're talking about humanities, liberal arts, and things like that, is very messy. So when we see things like, and please understand this is coming with the very best intent, okay? So when I see, like in line 1.12, where it says, provide as much information and data as possible, what data? I mean, exactly what are you looking for? I think that's the piece. Are you looking to see what did they go on and do? How long did it take them to complete it? Why did they change? I mean, it just seems to me like in some of our instances, that would be very complicated and very messy and very expensive for institutions to track over the course of years. So can you just help me understand it?
Representative Damon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. I understand your concerns with that. As much information as possible could go to the overall placement of students when completing their degree. Hopefully it is going to be in that line that they have actually studied for, but the overall completion of degree from that university or college is also going to be factored into this.
Madam Chair. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you. So then what do we do with students who start in one area and then transfer to another area and transfer to another area? As you well know, we both have children who are older. As you well know, students change their mind. They pursue different avenues. Something sparks their interest, and they go down a different path. Would that same data maybe mislead another student into thinking that wasn't a good career path or that wasn't a viable path, whereas the second student, it might be a great path? Do you see what I mean?
Representative Damon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. I do see what you mean, and as a mother of four adult children,
right.
We've taken a varied path along education right. In all four of them. I understand what you're saying. What this would do is just that transparency for a student to be able to look back. The completed degree is what the data would show, and then the overall graduation rate is what the intent of the bill is.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Cleavorn.
I would just like to say I think it's a good intent. I think it's very, very difficult data to track completely. And I think the SLEDS program that we paid for last year would be giving us the exact same information. That's what I think.
Okay, thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Representative Norness.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just noted that there was a fiscal note required or asked for, and it mm-hmm. comes up zero, so there's no cost. Mm-hmm. So that's in case you didn't note that. I guess what I was going to comment on is the fact that the way colleges, between the tuition costs and all of the other things, I would think this tool that this bill is requiring would be very helpful as parents and students make decisions on where they want to attend. I think the outcome is what they're looking for, you know, what they're paying for. And it's not going to be 100%. But I think it would be very helpful to have that as you decide some decisions based on the future outcome. So I think this is a very practical bill. Very needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nornes. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to thank the bill author, Representative Damuth, for bringing this forward. It is incredibly important. And I have had in my 6 years here, at least once per year, I've had college students, my constituents, make appointments with me, and they're very concerned about their debt, their college debt. And they, in the course of the conversation, I'll ask them, what did they go to school for? Where do they end up getting a job? How much are they making? How much is their current debt? And questions like this. And it comes out the fact that they're tens of thousands, $60,000, $80,000 in debt. They've graduated with a degree that's completely worthless. It has no marketable skills that an employer is willing to pay for. And I'm thinking in the back of my head, well, why did you go into tens of thousands of dollars of debt to get a worthless degree that an employer isn't going to hire you for? Right? We have a debt problem. We have a debt crisis. We've heard about it in this committee. We've heard about it in other committees. And the reason this is an important bill is to help provide maximum amount of available information so that students and parents can make discerning decisions and hopefully be turned away from investing money into worthless degrees. And so, and part of that will be available and increased transparency by linking up degree major with estimated income and success in placement. How could anybody be opposed to that? So thank you for this.
Thank you, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative DeMuth, I finally get to rave over a Republican bill in here. Normally it's Democrat bills that were being heard, and so the line of questioning is a lot different to their bill authors than what you're receiving today.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Representative Cleavorn, is it a point of order? Or?
That is a point of order. It goes to the intent of our questions. I would ask that an apology be rendered that is uncalled for as to the intent of our questions. I believe every member, no matter which side of this table they're sitting on, is honorable and should be dignified. And when we ask any question of any member, I believe that there is well-intentioned thought behind those questions. And so I would ask that last statement be acknowledged as inappropriate.
I think what I'll do is just remind members to focus on the bill and not the motives of other members, and try to be as respectful as possible. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So back to the bill here. My biggest complaint about college these days is I feel that colleges, universities have become predatory for students. The cost of tuition is constantly going up. Those same colleges come back to the legislature and say, please give us more money so we can keep our tuition down. They may raise it 2%, but had we not given them the money, they would have raised it more. It's time and time and time again. Students are graduating, not every student graduating with a lot of debt, but there's quite a few students that they are saddled with debt. As my colleague, Representative Lucero, said, they are coming out with degrees where they had anticipated that they'd be able to find a job in that career. They are shocked to find out that they are now working at Walmart. Or, you know, I've had a person say that, yeah, they are working at Walmart. They had a degree in whatever it was and unable to find a job. They're not able to make even the minimum payments. They've deferred. They're out of deferment. They have to pay on those loans. And they may still be living at their parents' home because they can't afford to move out, which then creates another issue, which is home ownership. College kids, when they're graduating, they're putting off marriage, they're putting off family, they're putting off buying a home because their first commitment is what? To paying off those student loans. And home ownership to me is very important. Home ownership is a pathway to to wealth, to financial stability, to a retirement fund in the future. And so to Representative DeMuth, thank you for bringing this bill forward and having that conversation and bringing some realistic expectations to students. If somebody wants to go into a degree that they may not be able to pay their student loans back as quickly as they would like, but are very passionate about that degree, at least that they will have a realistic expectation of what that looks like.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is actually for Mr. Savory.
Okay, go ahead, proceed.
I was just curious, the SLEDS report that we funded last year, can you tell me what the budget line was for that?
Mr. Savory.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. To clarify, the base budget for the SLEDS program, which is the Office of Higher Education, started last biennium when this committee took up the budget, was $1.7 million for the biennium. Subsequently, through the conference committee process, the budget for that particular item was increased by $1.8 million. So the total going forward is $3.5 million for the SLEDS program.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I asked the question is because of the fiscal note being $0. It seems to me that when we have looked at in-state government, when we have looked at modifying computer systems to collect this data, there's always a cost. When we think about the time it takes for somebody to input the data, there's always a cost. When we talk about students reporting the data, there's a cost. I just find it hard to believe that there would be, if we're saying that the legislature would have no cost, that's one thing. If we're saying that the universities and institutions that we're requiring to do this would have no cost, that's another statement. But collecting this type of data is not cheap and it takes time. And we want to make sure that students have an opportunity to succeed, and we want to make sure that students have the right information they need going forward to make questions. But I believe that's why we funded the SLEDS report. Thank you.
Representative Poppy. And we have one more person after that, and we're going to let Representative Damuth make her closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I won't belabor any point too much, but I just wanted to, I think students do, when they have more information, they can make better decisions. When they are aware of opportunities regarding careers, they can make better decisions. So I'm going to also just give this as a plug for having more counselors in school, either at the K-12 system, certainly throughout the high school, and I served, you know, for a number of years as a college counselor, and I can tell you that students can be undecided and unaware, I'd like to see them have more opportunities for understanding what the possibilities might be for their career and their education. I'm not saying that this is a wrong approach. I'm just wanting to make a point that I think there are other things too that we should and could be doing that would actually assist students in making better decisions for a lifetime. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Kwan, we have 2 minutes, and if we could like leave most of that for Representative Damuth, that would be wonderful. Representative Kwan.
I just want to illuminate that because we've funded SLEDS, because we've funded et cetera, the data is available, and my understanding is this would just be putting on the website, and frankly, if the school doesn't understand what it costs in tuition and fees, I'd be shocked. So they shouldn't even have to go to an outside prod to be able to do that.
Thank you, Representative Kwan. And then with that, we can now, Representative Damuth, would you like to make some closing remarks?
I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, thank you for taking time to, a short period of time, to listen to this bill. It's my first time in your committee, and I really appreciate that. I just want to draw your attention on the fiscal note, page 6, and I'll use this briefly. The websites of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities currently contain much of the information that is required in my bill. The information already includes some of this, so the cost to update their websites would be absorbed within those management budgets. It's just bringing it together in an effort to be more transparent for families and prospective students to make the best decision. We know that we have a workforce shortage. We also know that we have many opportunities for students. It's not that there's a right or wrong, but just that students would know what they're getting into to be able to follow their dreams and their career path. With that, thank you very much for hearing the bill.
Thank you. Hearing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House excuse me. Oh, excuse me. Oh, Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
To do
just a comment, quick comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Damuth, I heard you say this is your first time to the committee. Perhaps next time you can sweeten the pot a little bit. Thank you.
With your permission, Madam Chair, that crossed my mind at 2:30 when I was sitting in committee. I did see where I fell on the agenda.
Okay.
Nice catch.
Okay. And I believe, Representative Lean, were you the motion maker?
Yes, Madam Chair. Okay. I will renew the motion.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lean renews the motion that House File 4168 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. We are adjourned. Yeah.